the tabletop. Take away
game mechanics on display.
Three designers share the stage.
Pick a genre and we'll play
the tabletop. Take away.
Welcome back to the Tabletop Takeaway. I'm Ananda Gunaratna.
I'm Charlie McCarron.
And I'm Trevor Muller-Hagel.
And today we're going to be talking about Blood on the Clock Tower, which is a social deduction game, somewhat in the vein of Mafia and Werewolf, but I think a lot better.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So if you haven't played the Serve game, the basic premise is you have a group of people. Generally somewhere between 7 and 15. And some of the people are secretly selected as evil. And in the theme of Blood on the Clock Tower, the evil team is serving a demon, and the rest of the evil team is a bunch of minions who are supporting that demon. And the objective of the good team is to identify the demon and execute them, which they do during the day phase. The game is divided into days and nights. And during the days, people get to talk and nominate people to execute them, mob justice style.
Perfect.
And during the nights, the demon gets to wake up. Well, a lot of people get to wake up. But during the nights, everybody's asleep, and the demon gets to wake up and kill people. And if the demon can kill everybody, or at least all but one other player, that is, if the game gets down to two players, then the demon wins. And if the good team executes the demon before that happens, then the good team wins. Now, in Blood on the Clock Tower, there are a few things that are a little bit different than Werewolf and Mafia. I mean, for one thing, each player has a unique role, and these roles are quite well designed. Not all of the roles are necessarily helpful to the town. So on the good team, some players are townsfolk who have useful abilities, but some players are outsiders who have a variety of harmful abilities, but the outsiders are still on the good team and want to win. and then you on the evil team, of course, you have the minions and the demon. And
the storyteller, too, is kind of leading.
Right.
But they do play a role kind of determining. Like, you get to make decisions as the storyteller.
Yes, the storyteller is there to balance the game and to make it interesting. And this does sometimes mean making some decisions. And actually, some of the roles are only possible because of the existence of the storyteller. Like, for example, the savant every day learns one true and one false piece of information. And the storyteller has to come up with that information, which for me was, I'm usually the storyteller. For me, this was quite intimidating the first time I played Savant, but now I quite enjoy it because it's an opportunity to feed information and misinformation to the good team and sort of draw their attention in certain ways. So,
so you can watch while the day is going and see who gets suspicious of something.
Right.
And then you can do a false mislead with that information.
Yeah.
Which is just a fun thing to do, you know, sow chaos.
Yeah, yeah. So the storyteller role is a ton of fun. It's not one of these rote procedural type things that you see in other games. I guess
not surprising that a game designer would enjoy playing the storyteller role.
Yes, yeah, it's great fun for game design oriented people. Another thing about it, which is unlike Mafia, is that dead players still participate fully. And they even get one more vote, which they generally save until the very end of the game.
I like that about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good add to that game.
Yeah. I don't understand why. Well, anyway, doesn't matter. that's basically Blood on the Clock Tower. There are a few other things like the exact method of voting that I don't think we really need to go into right now. I think the thing that Blood on the Clock Tower really does really well, particularly better than other social deduction games, is the way that it balances information and misinformation, or information and doubt. Specifically, in that, last week we talked about One Night Ultimate Werewolf, And in One Night Ultimate Werewolf, when you learn information, it's very definite, right?
Right.
Like, if you're the seer and you look at a card, you know you looked at that card. You know you got that information. You know that information is true.
People may not believe you that you know that information, but that's a whole other thing.
Right. But in Blood in the Clock Tower, pretty much all the information comes with caveats and a possibility that you're wrong. Because you could be drunk, in which case the storyteller is lying to you. You could have been poisoned by an evil minion, and again,
your powers no longer work.
Right, and the storyteller is lying to you. You could have used your power on a roll that can give players false information, such as the recluse, and then the storyteller is lying to you. Even when you get information, there's generally a sort of a twist that leaves a little bit of uncertainty. Like, for example, the fortune teller gets to look at two people and learn if one of them is the demon, but one person can falsely register as the demon to the fortune teller. So you're never quite sure what the reason is.
Yeah, and I think, and this might bleed into my takeaway for the game, but the way the demons work is really cool and sets the tone of the whole game. Because the demons are kind of your win condition as the village. You got to figure out which demon it is of the four or so usually during a game. There's the different roles of the demons. You have to kind of deduce what they're doing during the night. Like, some examples are one demon will negate the people next to them,
right?
And if it's that kind of demon, you know,
yes, the figuring out which demon is in play is huge. Like in the game we played, you were the seamstress. And you were sitting right next to the Nodashi. And the Nodashi's ability poisons their neighbors so that they get false information.
Yeah.
And so if you can figure out that your information's false, you know where the demon is.
Yeah.
But if it had been, say, I don't know, a Vortox game, Vortox makes everybody's information false.
Right.
So, you know, sort of figuring out which one of those is the case is going to lead you to very different conclusions.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to know for sure if the information is false or not because you don't know what everything is.
Right. Yes. And I think part of the key here is that you have to talk to other people to figure out what they know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think I was talking a little bit last time about how getting people to talk to each other is important. And I think that's one thing that Blood in the Clock Tower does really well. It really encourages people to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know if this is standard, but how you run it anyways is that everyone can get up and like walk around different rooms in the house.
Have private conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think is really cool experience.
One Night Ultimate Werewolf is very good at creating that tabletop experience. But Blood on the Clock Tower feels more like a role play experience where you have this extended session of like, okay, you create relationships with people and you're like, okay, you're this. Okay, I'm this. So let's figure out what's going on with this person. See if we can bring them into our fold. And you can make alliances much easier than the 5 minutes that, you know, happens with One Night.
Yeah, it's really great because you can form factions with people.
Yeah.
And like, okay, it's us two against the world. We don't know who else? We don't know who the demon is, but we think we can trust each other, so we're on a team now.
Yeah.
And then that's a demon you just teamed up with.
Yeah, exactly. Didn't know. Yes. And then you feel bad if you accuse someone like Trevor.
Oh,
and
then yeah.
You were actually good,
I used my... Oh, yeah. I was good the whole time.
The whole
except
time.
Except for the one time.
Yeah. And so. It's like Murder Mystery Party, but...
Replayable,
yeah. And yeah. Just a lot more interesting roles going on.
I will say one big difference for me between One Night and Blood on the Clock Tower is how the roles are set up. So in One Night, you can kind of pick and choose your roles and what's going to be in this 5-minute game. Blood on the Clock Tower, you choose a script and everyone knows what all the roles are, but it's like it's a lot of roles.
Although, to be fair, in One Night, everybody also knows what all of the possible roles are.
Yeah, but I'm thinking more the total volume of selections.
Sure, yeah.
And then Blood on the Clock Tower makes it so it goes all into one script.
Right.
But you can have multiple scripts that all have unique roles in those scripts.
Which can be a little bit over... I think this is one of the difficulties because that can be... Like, as a new player, at least neither of you had played the script that we played, and Violets... how did you feel just looking at that big, huge list of like 24 roles?
It felt like a lot of work.
I liked it. But I really like learning what the different things can do. But I did get overwhelmed, absolutely.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, the 10 from mm-hmm. one night. It's not 10, right. It's more than 10, but yeah.
Well, and it's like it's a little bit of, like, there's different types of complexity in games. And one of them being, like, analytical complexity. Like, you just can't understand all the possible variations, which is
right.
what, like, yeah. chess. Chess, you know everything, but, like, the fact that you can't predict every turn out into the future makes it fun.
Right.
And this is a little bit like that, because you could forget about a certain role, and then someone brings it up, and, oh, no, that changes everything.
Vortox.
So it felt like that playing it for the first time in a fun
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
It's like...
Not being certain that you knew everything gave that sense of mystery all on its own. So I imagine that as you master it, I know one of the people that was playing, he got frustrated with everyone because we were not giving him our information. But then he also ended up being a demon in the later game. And it's like, right. well, yeah, I'm not going to give you my information. This right. is a social deduction game. Come on. Yeah. Like, no, you gotta know because we're juggling. I'm like, okay, man, that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think one thing that does help a little bit is death. And yeah. actually, this is probably a good time to
talk about death.
Yes, to talk. To, yes,
this that's is good... the direction our podcast is going.
All right, everyone. Here's our takeaway. So death.
Well, so one thing I think that players in social deduction games often don't get is that players dying is really pretty helpful to the good team.
Yeah.
Especially when the good players are the ones executing them, because as players die, it narrows down who the demon could be. Because if someone died and the game didn't end, that player is not the demon.
Right.
And good players are often very reluctant to execute people, and I think that's a horrible, horrible mistake.
And which is funny, in some sense.
Now, Blood in the Clock Tower can emulate a lot of social deduction games, one of which is actually a game like One Night Ultimate Werewolf where no one dies, which is specifically the Leviathan script,
okay.
which I actually ran a couple nights ago. And it's very different because since no one dies, you do not narrow down demon candidates, which means it is much, much harder for the town because they need to be very on top of their information to figure out who the demon is. Because
how does the demon win in that?
So in a Leviathan script, the demon doesn't kill. After the fifth day, if the town has not executed the demon, they lose. And if more than one good player is executed, the town loses. So when you put all those three things together, the town is very reluctant to kill people, which means that they're not eliminating demon candidates. So the only way that they can figure out who the demon is using their powers, which is actually pretty tough. So people dying makes things a lot easier for town. Mm. And I don't think people always appreciate that, but...
Well, I think it's a little unintuitive, I think, because... Well,
we're the
first
good
of all,
team. We don't want to kill good people on right. our team, but they do retain a vote.
Yeah.
Yeah, in that Blood on the Clock Tower specifically. But right. I think that goes against the intuition for most people
yeah.
right.
for a game like this.
Yeah. Also, the sheer number of games Blood on the Clock Tower emulates... Just brief story time. I think I may have told you guys this already, but back in high school, there's this game I found called Conspiracy. And the premise of Conspiracy is it's a social deduction game. Either there is a conspiracy or there isn't. If there is a conspiracy, then everyone except one person is a conspirator. Their job is to try to convince that one person there isn't a conspiracy. And if there isn't a conspiracy, then no one is a conspirator, and the goal is for everyone or a majority of players to collectively agree that there's no conspiracy. And it's this really cool idea, because like the idea of, you know, this paranoia of is everyone out against me or not? It's super cool, but the game is also very boring, because no one has any special roles.
Right.
It's just purely based on talking, which is an issue I also have with, say, Mafia. And Blood in the Clock Tower has something that emulates Conspiracy, which is the Legion role, where most of the players are evil demons, but they have no actual power.
Oh, that sounds hilarious.
Oh, it is. I love the Legion role. But they have no power in the sense that they cannot choose who dies at night, and their votes don't count during the day unless a good player votes with them.
Oh, wow.
And Legion is so engaging, and it's basically the, you know, it's the feeling I wanted from Conspiracy, but that game just didn't deliver. So Blood in the Clock Tower does a really good job of emulating other social deduction games with all the sheer number of demons in play.
Yeah.
How many total rolls do you think there are official?
Off the top of my head, way more than 100. I don't think more than 200, but I probably should know this. But
well, that's a lot. That's a lot.
A large number of rolls.
And how many official
scripts
are there?
Well, I mean, there's three official scripts. I think they're going to probably release more at some point.
Right, they actually release official roles that are not part of an official script.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But
people can make their own scripts.
People can make their own scripts.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And how many user scripts are in? Like, where do you find the scripts? Is there a database?
There is a database. I think it's like botc-azure. I don't remember what the address is, but there is a database for scripts with like hundreds of scripts on there, where you can just download PDFs or JSONs to use.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Well, what do you guys think for takeaways on Blood on the Clock Tower?
So, I think there are a lot of takeaways, but I think the big one that I would have is that the key to a really good social deduction game is properly balancing hard information that players can use to, you know, reason about the state of the game with doubt, where players don't trust the info or don't trust other players, sort of forcing them to both use the data to come to conclusions. Like, it's not a game like Mafia where you have no real information to go on. But the rare data that is irrefutable should have a price. And Blood in the Clock Tower does a really good job of this. Any information you get generally comes with a price, either in terms of uncertainty of the information, or sometimes you can get absolute hard data, but at a cost. For example, the Virgin roll from the Trouble Brewing script, if a townsfolk nominates them, that townsfolk is immediately executed, which absolutely proves that the Virgin is who they say they are, and also mostly proves that townsfolk is who they say they are, unless, of course, they're a spy. But, that's a big cost, right? Someone has to die to get that information. So I think absolute information should come with a cost, and otherwise information should have some sort of uncertainty attached so that players need to cross-reference it with each other to get them talking to each other. I think that's the key to a good social deduction game.
Nice. I think for me the takeaway is getting players up and out of their seats and like moving around and making those factions like you mentioned. I think that's a really cool experience that we forget about as tabletop game designers, of just like you're going to be sitting at the table, but people will remember those kind of games just because they're like physically in doing something different. And like Two Rooms and a Boom.
I was going to mention this actually. Yeah.
That one is like specifically you have to have two rooms and you're moving between them.
Yep.
Actually, three rooms ideally.
Having a two, hallway in between or like an intermediary area.
Yeah. Other than those two and Murder Mystery Parties, I don't think I've played a game board, tabletop.
A hobby game.
Yeah, hobby game. There we go. Yeah, that does that. So.
Honestly, I was going to say the same thing because I had never actually played Blood on the Clock Tower, not at a table. So we always played it like One Night Ultimate Werewolf where you're just at your spot and, you know, you're talking around with people next to you. And it really confines your conversations. And, you know, if you're playing with 10 people, they're all the way like across from you and you hear what they say to the group. But if they're talking to someone next to them, you'd have no idea. So, yeah, I think there's a real big benefit to getting people to move up and move around for longer, specifically longer social deduction games, too.
Mm-hmm.
But for a unique me takeaway, I'm going to then lean into the scripting, the scripts. Having a solid piece that can be referenced, especially in a longer game. One night it works because it's 5 minutes long. And then if you – I don't remember what this ability did. I'll have to listen to it the next time we go to bed. Great. Then you can hear it again. You get refreshed on what it does. But for Blood on the Clock Tower, obviously you don't get those reminders. And having that script in front of you and being able to reference that and see all the different possibilities can kind of help, like, you not worry about keeping everything in your head. And that's, mm-hmm. I think, really key is, like, okay, I had that conversation with this person. They said this. And then you can remember on a piece of paper where that was and just helps you with the rest of the experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, just having that physical thing.
That's a little like my backup.
Oh, really? That
takeaway too. Just, well, more so that there are all these different scripts out there for the same roles to be reused. And and getting people so excited that they're creating user content for the game in a database.
The publisher is specifically creating roles that are not in a script. And, like, that's a great sign for that community, you know? Like, oh, they got this. Okay, let's give that one a try in this script or this script. Like,
that's cool.
It can really energize the community more and more, you know, which is great.
Yeah.
One last thing, which we didn't really talk about and didn't come up in the game we played. But one cool thing about Blood in the Clock Tower is the traveler and fabled mechanics, and in particular the attention of the game to accessibility. So travelers are, this is a mechanic where if somebody shows up late to the game or has to leave early, they can take a traveler role, which means everyone knows what their ability is but not which team they're on. And if they're evil, then they're working for the demon, which is really cool because it means people can join late or leave early, which I don't think I've seen any other game have something built in to handle that.
No.
That's cool.
And I think that could be really useful in a lot of games, even outside of social deduction games. And then fabled. Fabled means that there's a special rule, and everyone knows the game's been modified. And some of the fabled roles are really helpful for, like, for example, young players. There's, I think it's called the Revolutionary, if I'm remembering right. It means that everybody knows that two players have the same alignment, and once per game, one of them can register falsely to an ability. So, like, if you have a really young player who needs some help, you can make them a revolutionary with an experienced player, so that they know and everyone knows that they're on the same team, and so then they can work together. And there's a bunch of things like this, which I think is just really cool.
Yeah, very clever game.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So clever. Sorry.
Yeah. So that's another game.
I did it again. Ah.
Yeah. So, well, tune in next time for our final of the three games. We're going to do Fake Artist Goes to New York.
Thank you for listening.
Hey, thanks for listening to The Tabletop Takeaway. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. So please tell your friends and visit our website at thetabletoptakeaway.com, where you can suggest games and mechanics for us to cover next on the show.